Blog Talk Radio.
The dead of night, when thy winter wounds shall not be healed from the wind which howls about your being. In the dead of night, when your friends have gone and you sit huddled around the castle's fire. In the dead of night, when all is dark, who will you be tonight?
You are about to experience the all of mystery which reaches from the inner mind into the shadows of the Night Zone.
Good evening, everybody. Glad you could join us tonight in the Night Zone. I'm Colin Knight. Intended for open-minded audiences. All information provided by guests or speaker are the ideas or realities of that person or organization. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality and valued information, Night Zone or its operators do not accept any liability for guest opinions or statements made. And as a valued listener, we remind you always keep your mentor. Ladies and gentlemen, madam and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants, mon ami.
Welcome to another edition of the Night Zone. Tonight, we shall be taking a look back at a few of our guests. And as we take a look back on a few of our guests, we do welcome you to another edition of the Night Zone. It is Tuesday, October the 6th. 10:03 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 degrees Celsius in the city of Calgary, Alberta, Canada. That's 48 degrees Fahrenheit for our American listeners. It's a chilly one and a windy one. Tonight, we should be looking back on last month's guests, an impressive gathering of intelligence. Kicking us off tonight is a group from Cosmic Conspiracies. Now, this was a technically difficult show, and it was obvious by the powers that be that they didn't want this group to release the information. We were mercilessly cyber-attacked while taping, and in an attempt, I can only guess, to stop the information from getting out, but we managed to get most of it out. Ladies and gentlemen, Cosmic Conspiracies.
Dave, good to see you, good to hear you. Glad you could make it to the Night Zone, sir. NASA, like I was saying to Martin, I'm not fully sure whether I buy the cover-up story, but the reading, the information is scientifically fascinating.
Yeah, that's right. I've got a very popular article on the web. It's the most popular article, which is called The Apollo Hoax, on the website, and that's had over 2 million hits now. I wrote that originally in 2000, and since then, especially over the last year, I've gone back into the NASA archives, and people have contacted me with new information, and I am just about to update that article with a new 5-part series. Right. And some of the stuff which I've uncovered is, well, we're not you on the floor.
Yeah. Okay, well, in a nutshell, let's compress the story of NASA. Where, with all of the information that you have gathered over the years, and all of the writing that you have done, how would you encapsulate the story? What would you say that NASA is guilty of or not guilty of?
Well, from research over the years, I would say that, first of all, I've got to say that I'm not necessarily saying that man didn't go to the moon, but I believe that the photographs and the film footage is bogus, which we see.
And why do you think they would have altered or replaced the footage? What would have been their reasoning?
Well, there's several reasons, really. Number one, obviously, it was during the Cold War, so they had to try and make the rest of the world believe, especially the Soviets, that they were more technically advanced. So the race was on, really. In fact, a lot of people don't know that when the Apollo 11 was landing, the Russians actually had a probe, I think it was a Luna 5, which hit the lunar surface as it was landing. And that actually made the surface ring for an hour and a half, which is another interesting thing to look into, to see if the moon is hollow. There's that. Also, obviously, you've got the Van Allen radiation belts, which would, in my opinion, would have completely wrecked the film footage and the photographs as they come back through space. Okay. And also
and that's a good point that we've all well, not nowadays, but in the past, I have experienced taking through rolls of film through an airport, and by the time I got home and had them developed, they were ruined because of the X-ray machines. So yes, yeah. I can relate to that theory, but we would hope that they would have thought about that and somehow shielded it in some manner, if that was possible. But the intensity of the radiation in the Van Allen belt is basically a death sentence.
That's right. Not only that, around about, I think it was 10 years before the Apollo mission started, the government actually, this is the US government, did an operation called Operation Starfish Prime, where they sent a nuclear bomb up into space, and the effects of that was it actually caused a third radiation belt, which was a lot more toxic than the natural belts, which were discovered by Van Allen.
So the barriers from here to the moon would be a superhuman feat.
That's right. What you've got to take into consideration is that every space mission which has gone since the Apollo missions has gone no further than 400 miles up into space. They come nowhere near the radiation belts, and yet there are Russian cosmonauts who were saying that they are going blind from, you know, radiation, and they're thousands of miles away from the actual Van Allen radiation belts. And also they see a phenomenon which is called cosmic rays, which, again, is from radiation. But so you can imagine, if these guys actually went through the belts, I don't think many of them will be here to tell the tale today.
You think it was a lot of bravado because of the Cold War systems? Or where do we stand with the moon mission? Because once again, it has been trumpeted as the next big thing for NASA.
And it was at this point things really started going downhill.
Going downhill is an understatement. We were hit with a cyber attack as we were recording live from the UK. And their cell phones were going dead, their home phone lines were clicking. We even tried to do a Skype, and it was getting more and more difficult. But as true warriors of the internet psychic works, we continued. Boy, did they ever head downhill. Dave managed to get the information out. To recap, NASA faked the moon landing. Russia made the moon ring like a bell for 90 minutes, supposedly as the moon lander was touching down, proving that the signal showed that NASA never actually landed when they said they did. That gamma rays destroying TV signals and videotape. TV signals could not be broadcast at the values supposedly sent from the moon, even with the relays from the orbiter. And 400 miles is the maximum that astronauts can go into space now. Yet it's thousands of miles away from the Van Allen belt. And Dave believed it was fake due to the Cold War mentality. At first, when I heard the stories and read the information
on the Cosmic Conspiracies website. I again put tongue in cheek and thought of the conspiracy mentality regarding the various presidents and the like, their big brother and what have you. But the more we do these shows, the more we realize that there are powers that are moving in nefarious circles that we may never be fully aware of for whatever reasons. Now, the information that Dave is releasing, he gleaned from doing his research and released documents and released information. This isn't something that he threw together on a whim. This is a great deal of research. And if you go to the Cosmic Conspiracies website, you will see that they've got some grand stuff up there, some pro and some con. We all know a con when we see one. So caveat emptor always when dealing with information of the paranormal and extraterrestrial. These people are straight shooters. They're bringing it to you as they have heard it, and as they have seen it, and as they have explored it and researched it. They're not fly-by-nights. These people are in for the long haul. A website that's been up and running 10 years. Imagine the quality of information that website has.
What was interesting is a couple of weeks ago, obviously, we just celebrated the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landings. And during the John Glenn lectures at the Smithsonian Museum, a guy by the name of Christopher Kraft, who was ahead of the director of the Johnson Space Center at one time, during the Apollo missions, actually was talking about the Apollo 1 tragedy with the fire and said, basically, completely damned the mission during that lecture and said that the technicians didn't know what they were doing, and after the fire they basically scrapped the lunar module and started again. So the lunar module, Apollo 1 fire happened in January 1967. So what he's actually saying in reality is 18 months later they managed to rebuild the lunar module and go to the moon within an 18 month time span. And in 2004 President Bush said that we would go back to the moon by 2020, which is a 16-year gap. So my big question is, why would it take twice as long from his announcement that we would go to the moon, 16 years, when Kennedy said in 1961 we would go to the moon?
Yeah.
The difference in the technology between now and then should be far more superior, so why would it take twice as long?
Cosmic Conspiracy Team out of the United Kingdom, Dave and Martin.
You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com.
And it was a fabulous interview, and unfortunately we couldn't get it all to air because of the technical glitches. We have asked Cosmic Conspiracies to come back, and I do believe we have them scheduled either at the back end of October or the beginning of November.
Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone.
September the 8th, we had a double guest, Bill Grant Cameron from presidentialufos.com and Richard Phillips, who is the author of The Roe Agenda. Let's have a listen to Grant, see what he had to say for himself. Or maybe not. Good old blood.
Presidential UFOs. Now, you've got my attention on that, I'll tell you. How many presidents knew what and when? Is this pervasive in the presidency?
Well, that's the big question, is who knew what and when. And that gets kind of confusing. For almost any president, I can tell you three stories that show that they knew and three stories that show that they might not have known. There seems to be no doubt that Truman knew what was going on. Eisenhower, that gets a little foggy as to who knew what. One of the sort of basic things I think a lot of people agree on was that Bill Clinton was very interested in the phenomena, tried to figure out what was going on, and was not able to get any answers. So those kind of things we sort of know, and there's a number of rumored stories about Jimmy Carter on one hand knowing and then on the other hand not knowing. There are some good stories about presidents being interested in trying to figure out what's going on.
Right. So let's head back to Eisenhower. What exactly was taking place that caused Eisenhower to be aware of UFOs?
Well, Eisenhower may have known even before he became president. He was commander of the Allied forces in Europe when Roswell took place, was involved in a couple of meetings in and around Roswell with some of the key generals that were rumored to have been involved. So he may have known as early as back at the time of Roswell what was going on, that they had actually recovered something. When he gets into power, one of the problems with studying Eisenhower in terms of UFOs was that Eisenhower was very conscious of security. There's even stories told when he was the vice president, when he was being briefed as vice president, this was all very secretive, and they would take him across town, put him in through a building, take him out the back door down there just to go to an apartment to do the briefing, which now everybody knows where the briefing is. It's held in a, you know, a secure vault type thing, but people know when the briefing is. But back in Eisenhower's day, for whatever reason, even his presidential briefings that happen when a president comes in, a president-elect is usually briefed by the CIA director from the former administration, and that's when they're basically told you know, what the status of the country is and what kind of secrets and what kind of military operations are going on, this sort of stuff. So Eisenhower is very, very secretive, and there was some stories that sort of indicated that he may have known what was going on. For example, the famous MJ-12 papers, which were leaked back in the mid-1980s, which have come under a lot of question, and there's a number of other MJ-12-style documents that were released in the 1990s that were floated around, and all that seemed to center around, especially the first one, the MJ-12 documents, were purportedly a briefing that was given to President Eisenhower on the status of UFO information. Now, the one big story that happens in the Eisenhower administration, which I tracked, I went to the Eisenhower Library, and I believe that Bill Moore he was a very prominent researcher back in the 1980s. He spent a lot of time checking this story at the Eisenhower Library. That was the story about Eisenhower going to Edwards Air Force Base. This is in February of, I believe it was 1954. And there is no doubt he was on vacation at Palm Springs, California, and there's absolutely no doubt that he disappeared. In fact, the media was ready. One of the reporters from New York was ready to put on the wire that the president had a heart attack and had died, and the press secretary for the president actually stopped the story from going on, sort of gathered the reporters together and sort of crushed this story that the president had died. And the rumored story that started to appear in UFO material even a couple weeks after this incident by UFO groups in the 1950s was that Eisenhower had gone to Edwards Air Force Base. And the story's been various to what happened, whether he was shown dead alien bodies. But the story back in the 1950s was that he had met with aliens at Edwards Air Force Base.
Was there any presidential involvement prior to Roswell? Or was Roswell kind of the kickoff point for the Blue Book and the likes?
No, I think sort of ufology has sort of missed a couple of stories. There is presidential documents that take place in, this would be February of 1942. This is the overflight of an object in Los Angeles, and this is where they opened 1,400 rounds of ammunition, and I think there was actually about 7 people killed by this ammunition coming down. It was written up extensively for about a week and a half in the Los Angeles Times, and this was this object that had flown over, and there is actual presidential correspondence with General Marshall, who was Secretary of War at the time, and Marshall writes a letter to the president, or a memo, basically stating what had happened, that this object had come over and that they had shot at the thing.
The story you are about to hear is true.
Now, there's no way we could get all of Grant's information in the time that we had allotted for him. And he's another one of our guests that we've asked Grant to return for a deep look at what the presidents know of the U.S. Of the UFO conspiracies. And I have to say that Grant is probably one of the busiest experts we have in a while. But let's listen a little bit more.
The way we work in the world is we sort of look at the world as sort of a dualistic world, that there's good and there's evil, and there's good people and bad people. In ufology, we sort of see that we're trying to get the secret out. We're trying to reveal what's going on. That means makes us the good people, and anybody who's covering up the secret, who is in government, becomes the bad people. And I think we've sort of gone off course with this. I don't think that's really what's actually going on, because whether you look at George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., any of the presidents, you take a look at how they deal in normal life, and if you read their presidential documents, you'll find out that they're exactly the same as you and I. They've got kids, they've got grandkids, they want the best for future generations. So to assume that a president or people who are covering this up are evil and that they are doing the wrong thing, I think sort of gets us off course, because I think they have done what they think was right in covering it up. And so I started to work on this whole idea, and then Jimmy Carter was the inspiration of it. Or actually, let's go back one more step. When I went to university, when I was young, what I had studied was political science, and my main interest was Russian Soviet studies, because back in the 1970s, that was where it was at. It was the Cold War. It was Russia versus the United States. And anybody that worked on the Soviet Union would work on to become a criminologist in studying the Kremlin. And it was basically, I remember a story being told that you assumed that the Russians were all evil people, and that I remember the professor once saying, what would happen if you landed in the middle of Moscow and you said, okay, I'm here to rescue you, what would happen? Well, basically, the citizens would just basically shoot you, because they believe that their government's doing the right thing and that they're on the right course. So what criminologists did was they basically looked at what was going on in the Kremlin. And you would look at this person moves, that person moves, this person is getting elected, because it was a very secretive type of government, the same as the UFO situation is very secretive. So you're sort of reading between the lines, you're looking at movements, what people are saying, you're interpreting what people are saying. And that's the way I started to look at ufology, is to look at, especially Jimmy Carter was the inspiration. Jimmy Carter was a very religious man who believed in telling the truth. He had taught Sunday school since he was like 16 years old, and had taught every Sunday all the way through his presidency. Was this type of guy that I sat there, and he had gone out in the 1976 campaign, and he said, if I become president, I'm going to release all the information on UFOs. I had a UFO sighting, he went through the whole thing, and he goes into the presidency and he doesn't say a thing. He just suddenly shuts up, he doesn't say anything, and now he's even in a position where he's actually saying, well, no, he really doesn't believe it's extraterrestrial, and you know, there's really no evidence, and he's going down this path. And I sat there and I wondered, if you were a guy who wanted the UFO secret out and you ended up in the White House, what is it that changes the president's mind? What is it that they come in and tell the president that suddenly will flip somebody? For example, Barack Obama. Barack Obama said, you know, there's too much secrecy. We've got to release all this. We've got, you know, he's in this whole open government transparency. He walks into the presidency and suddenly he's basically no different than any other president. And so that's the way I looked at the UFO situation. Was what is the briefing? What is it that they sit the president down that makes him say, yeah, you're right, it's not time for this to be released? And I look at all the sort of concepts of why is this thing being kept secret? Because I think it now goes beyond the president. I think it goes to basically a group that has been around for an awful long time, whether you want to call them the cabal or the MJ-12 or something. There is some sort of as Bill Clinton said when he was asked about why don't you do something about the UFO situation, he said, he was talking to Sarah McClendon, the long-time White House reporter. He said, Sarah, there's a government inside the government, and I don't control it.
Yeah.
And I think that is basically a situation that we find existing, and that when you sit down and you assume, number one, that the people who are covering this up aren't evil, that they are doing what they think is right, and you start looking at some of the things that might be told, it starts to make sense as why they're covering it up. Now, that doesn't mean that it's right what they're doing, that they're covering it up, but the same as when you study the Soviet government, right, you have to understand how they think, what's happening behind the scenes in order to move ahead and to try to get that right.
and good old blogtalkradio.com decided to give me an air break. Wasn't that nice of them?
You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com.
And during the 8th, we also, as I said earlier, we had a double bill. We had Richard Phillips was with us. Now, Richard is a writer with a number of books under his wing. From the Row Agenda is a series of books. And we were talking with Richard regarding The Second Ship, which was the latest book that Richard is writing. And Richard has a great deal of experience. He's worked at Los Alamos and another of other restricted sites. Richard Phillips. Come on now, Blog Talk. You can do this. Giddy up, go. And as usual, blogtalkradio.com.
And we are back with Richard Phillips, author of The Second Ship, a book through the Row Agenda series.
Most of us really wonder when when you hear things like what Grant was talking about and you see what's available as public information on exciting technologies that the government right now, or that, you know, that not the government, that just scientists around the world are working on, it makes people wonder, well, I think they'd like to take a peek and wonder what's going on that's highly classified if all this other amazing stuff's going on that's not classified.
Right.
And since I had the privilege of working at some of those places on those type of projects, I get a lot of questions about how much of the second ship and the technologies in the Row Agenda and the scenario of the Row Agenda is based on some semblance of reality. Now,
right.
Now, one thing I have to always caveat is background I come from and the classification levels that I operated in. You know, there are certainly limitations on what I can talk about. But at the same time, what I tried to do in the Row Agenda series was put as much real science in there as possible, plus a flavor of some of the things that we are very, very close on. Now, whether these things are from reverse engineering of alien technologies like the scenario in The Second Ship, I can't comment directly on, but I think I think when people see what's about to happen over this next 7 years, it's going to raise a lot more questions than are out there right now, because we are getting ready to roll out a variety of breakthrough technologies, some of which I talk about in The Second Ship, but many of which are going to be incredibly startling.
Right. Now, would you say that these technologies could possibly be, and I mean possibly be, some form of back engineering?
I won't discount that. Just to give a little bit of a flavor to your listeners, that is exactly the story in my series, the Row Agenda series. Okay. Essentially, the president comes out right at the beginning of the series and announces to the public, like we'd all like to hear, that the federal government has had a program for a number of decades trying to reverse engineer a damaged alien craft. And the only reason he comes out and announces it is because they've made some recent breakthroughs current day that are just too important. I mean, he can't keep them bottled up anymore. They finally cracked the code, you might say. And so that spins up my set of novels based on that particular scenario. But getting back to your question, you know, there's a bunch of things that are happening right now that everybody's aware of that are about to have a revolutionary type of effect. And I won't directly say whether these are alien technologies. I'll leave that to the judgment of other people, but for example, one of the things that a lot of people think is an outlandish technology that's in the second ship is this this technology that allows the direct linkage of a person's mind with a computer system. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's some news stories out right now of all kinds of research going on to do exactly that. Everything from allowing the blind to see, allowing paralyzed people to move the mouse cursor on computer screens with just thinking, you know, they put on the right kind of headset, they think about what they want to do, and the computer does it. Voice recognition, pattern recognition. There's some frightening technologies, actually, that involve really an analysis and computer recognition of the patterns of our brain waves. So these are all publicly available pieces of information. And what one of the things I've been watching for a number of years is indications of something that was a big subject of research for the last several decades, which is euphemistically known as artificial intelligence research. You know, essentially that was pretty much regarded as a huge failure, because we could not make any significant progress along those lines. But right now, progress is being made, but it's being made in unexpected ways. We still don't understand. We don't have a good clue of how that whole equation works. How do you design a computer that learns and thinks? What I've been believing for some time is that when it happens, it's going to happen not in a way we expect. Computers are getting closer and closer to learning on their own. And
they are getting closer and closer to learning on their own. There's no doubt about
that. Welcome to the shadows of the night zone.
And when it comes to what's going to happen in the future, I dig back to a program we did with John Hoag last year, actually, and he made a very good prediction regarding coming into the age of Aquarius.
Aquarian age is a time of greater spontaneity. It's going to be a time where the era of the great faith-based religions of the Piscean Age will fade and be replaced by religions that are more scientific. Rather than to believe, the next 2,000 years is about knowing,
and that's what it's all about. But Richard Phillips' stories are very compelling. I've read the Roe Agenda, and I'm in the middle of the second ship. And I have to tell you that the storyline is absolutely fascinating.
The story starts, like I mentioned, with the president. The president comes out and announces they have had a ship and they've had some breakthroughs on it, and he's going to start rolling out these technologies, these, quote, beneficial technologies to the public. But meanwhile, you know, the actual opening chapter is a flashback 30 years in the past, back to 1977. And there's this tunnel below Groom Lake. It's a huge place with the railroad tracks that go down through it, and it's in this tunnel that the government has this damaged alien ship, and they've been trying since the 40s to try to reverse engineer the thing, and they've made no progress, zero. You know, they haven't been able to chip the paint on the thing, but it so happens this is where we run into the one of the major characters in the book, a guy at the time, he's this young, brilliant military research guy. But the scientists on that program have kind of lost interest. They've kind of lost some enthusiasm after spending 30 years working on the thing and making no progress. They're starting to take their weekends off, not working around the clock, doing that kind of thing. So this scientist, at the time he's got his master's degree, Donald Stevenson, gets permission to set up an experiment of his own design against the side of the spacecraft. And he gets permission, but only if he'll do it over Thanksgiving weekend and have everything put back like it was by the time the scientists come back in the following Monday. Well, his experiment ends up being the one that actually opens the ship. So then we flash forward to present day, and you mentioned one of the things I get asked all the time, since this is such an adult series, why did I pick three high school juniors as the main protagonists in this?
Mm-hmm.
And there's really two reasons for it. Number one, that just happens to be the same age of kid that every military in the world uses as their frontline soldier. You know, they're looking for those 17, 18-year-olds. And the reason for that is, if you think about teenagers, at that age, they have a very poor sense of their own mortality, for one thing. And for another thing is they're out to prove themselves, whether they're guys or girls. And these three young people are bright young people. Their dads work at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. And they're out before the school year starts, rock climbing, doing whatever. They end up stumbling on this cave and finding this second ship, not the one the government has. And they quickly discover what the reader discovers early on, is that there were actually two ships that arrived back in the 40s, and these ships ended up shooting each other down. They were fighting when they got here, and they both crashed. And the government found one, and the second one isn't found until present day, and that's the name, the second ship. Mm-hmm. So what happens in brief is these kids, being who they are, they know they should turn this thing over to the government. It's an important find. But they also know if they do that, they'll never get a chance to take a look at the thing. So they decide to take a peek inside. And they can actually get into this thing because it's got a hole punched through it from the weapon of the other ship. Mm-hmm. Well, when they get up in there, they find out, they end up trying on, messing around with some equipment they shouldn't mess around with, and they end up activating a link between the shipboard computer systems and these headsets they put on, and it forms a direct tie-in to their brain, and ends up putting them in a situation where they feel like that the ship that the government has technologies on it that should not, definitely should not be released to the public. And because of that, they're in a bad situation. They can't report it to the government. They're only juniors in high school. They can't really tell their parents about it. They work at the laboratory. They'll lose their clearance or it'll be turned over. So they know they're in completely over their heads, and so they are scrambling, trying to find a way to deal with this situation. And the plan they come up with gets them in even more trouble, which is they decide to drop an anonymous message to the NSA that something is wrong with the research being done inside the Rogue Project. So anyway, this whole thing just spins out of their control. And it ends up being a situation where these nice, comfortable lives they've got at the beginning of the story just get put through the meat grinder in this series.
And as the story twists and turns regarding the second ship, I have to tell you that it's the type of reading you just can't put it down. It's my book on my nightstand. And as I say, we should be through that by the end of the week, because I like to read a paragraph or a chapter and kind of sit back and think about it and check the reality of it all. And Richard Phillips, with his expertise from Los Alamos and various other places, he makes it real. He makes it very real. September the 15th. We had our ghost hunter friend and Recce master on the show, Eileen Smith. And Eileen brought us the meaning of Recce. And believe me, very interesting. We have with us tonight Eileen Smith, Recce master, good friend of the show. Welcome back to the Night Zone, Eileen.
Well, thank you for having me again. Pleasure.
More than a pleasure. Tonight's a little different. Normally we're pulling on your ghost hunting talent, but tonight you've taken off your ghost hunting hat, and we're bringing a new topic to the show. You and I have spoken at length about your involvement with the investigations and the South Jersey Ghost Research Group, and how Recce assisted you in your investigation. I guess the best place to start tonight is a little background on exactly what Recce is.
Well, Recce, there is a little bit of a blurred history with it. It was there's a few school of thoughts on it. It Reiki means universal life force, and it's thought to have originated in Tibet about 2,500 years ago. It's a laying, a very gentle laying of on of hands technique based on ancient symbols, and helps to restore balance and harmony to the body. And I like to think of it as relaxing the body to the point where the body can heal itself. But it also, there's also some history coming out that it's said that Jesus actually was using Reiki, a form of Reiki that he learned from the Essenes when he studied with them, and they were using Reiki as well. So no one's really quite sure how old it really is. Well, and I've been doing a form of energy work since I was a little kid, to be honest with you. And then I became interested, I was always interested in Reiki, and just, you know how they say when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. So I learned from a Reiki master teacher. I think I received, back in 1998, that I received my Reiki master level. So I've been doing it since then. The thing is, with the Reiki, it creates such a positive energy within yourself. It balances mind and the emotions so that you're more positive. And we find it seems to be a naturally occurring, especially with South Jersey ghost research, because when we're going into paranormal situations, you really do have to have a positive energy about you. In Reiki and in other metaphysical studies, it's felt that if negativity kind of, let's say, diminishes the natural protection that a person has around their energy body, like their aura, some people call it aura, and if your aura is very weak, then you're prone to pick up negative energies, whether it's from a ghost or a living human being. Have a weak aura, and also things like drugs and alcohol can weaken it too. So as investigators, we just, my friend Jamie and I are in South Jersey Ghost Research, both Reiki masters. The investigators just naturally took to it and found it helped them ward off the effects of being in a, sometimes we are in a situation where, you know, the spirit in the home is, as in life, is not the greatest person in death. And also, the investigators, as well as myself, found that the longer we did Reiki, both giving Reiki to others and receiving Reiki for ourselves, we became more intuitive.
And we're about 45 minutes into a 90-minute show. And as we continue, I have to say that the more I look into Reiki, the clearer its abilities do become. In fact, I'm currently studying from a master in Calgary under Eileen's recommendation and hope to fully understand this universal force, but I must say it has already paid me dividends.
So from what I'm hearing from this is that by creating the old adage, if you can do one thing good for one person a day, the universal force, the law of reciprocity is that this positive energy, if you will, builds up in your workplace, in your play place, you know, in your bedroom, in everywhere.
Absolutely. So, and I also find that gratitude tends to be extremely positive energy, that it coats people's energy field, gratitude. Even, you know, just find something that you, and I'm sure everyone can, to feel grateful for, whether, even though you may be going into a job that's full of negativity, just being grateful that you have a job, or just looking at something positive does tend to really build a strong protection.
Just a mindset that you have to put yourself into, because it's so easy to fall into that negative, well, you know, I'm not as good looking as Johnny, and I'm not as smart as Sally, and I'm not as rich as Bill, and you can get into that negative force so easily, and then there's no way out.
Absolutely, and I do find also people have to really step up, keeping themselves positive, keeping the negative from attaching. I think lately, the past several years, or really especially this year, there's a lot of fear on the planet. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of chaotic energy, and people, whether they're conscious of it or not, are feeling the effects of it. And I really hope that if anything, you know, people get out of the show tonight is to explore these things to create a more positive life. And things like angels as well, you know, calling on one of the most wonderful protectors, Archangel Michael, to protect, and also to, Archangel Michael is incredible for removing any attachments or any negative energy that doesn't belong on you. You can just say his, really just say his name, and just say, Michael, can you, you know, just clear me, clear all of this gunk off me. And it's that simple. It's, and I'll tell you something. I know it sounds kind of, you know, hokey to some people, but it's very real, and it actually works that instantaneously. I've had a number of experiences in my life where I've been protected and my life has been saved with Archangel Michael. These people have, you know, we live on a planet of human beings, and everybody's fighting their own battle, inner battle, but people can resent people who they, you know, feel are more successful, or, and send that kind of thought form. We do have to protect ourselves from that. And so, you know, you're kidding around, but, you know, that could be something that's actually going on.
And it could be something that's going on. We've talked about the psychic vampires on the Internet, in the Internet chat rooms, how they suck your strength and leave you empty after they have done their bit in the chat rooms. And it's true, negative energy is the powerful force. And the more I talk to Eileen and her group, the deeper the commitment in what they do becomes very, very obvious. It's using a life force. It's using the universal energy. You're not praying to a deity. You're not, you know, you're not trying to convince people that Christianity, Catholicism, Judaism, Muslim, none of that is being affected. Reiki is almost an advanced tool to add to your religious beliefs. That's how I'm seeing it.
That is perfect. I couldn't have said it better. You really nailed it, Colin. It has no religion, and it's just pure positive life force energy from whatever that person feels is the source of such things. Years go by, most Reiki people are able to sense those things. Those who are first starting out, and that's why I kind of recommend that you go with someone who's been doing it for a number of years, so you get the whole experience. I'm absolutely able to sense when someone is out of alignment, out of balance, where the whole, you know, because Reiki does address the whole organ system as well. It detoxifies the body. It builds up the immune system. So all of that kind of stuff is also being addressed, you know. And I can sense things like that. And I'll stay in certain areas of the body longer because I sense that. And because I am an angel practitioner and an intuitive healer, I also hear. I'll sometimes hear somebody we call spirit guide or something tell me, you know, you need to go here, you need to go to their knee or something like that, and I'll do that, you know. But you really don't, if somebody wants to become a Reiki practitioner, you don't have to really do anything. The Reiki knows, it's a conscious energy, so it knows where to go. For example, I could be at someone's feet, but yet something's going on in their shoulder. That Reiki will find its way to the shoulder, and, you know, even if the practitioner doesn't know to go there, it has a consciousness. And so you really don't have to have a lot of intuition or anything like that. You just need to be that telephone wire and lay your hands on that. On that body, I find it incredibly peaceful and healing when I get Reiki. It's almost, for people like you were talking about, you know, about people talking about it being a cult and everything. which is, of course it isn't. But the way I like to tell people, a lot, some people, I just tell them that, you know, when you get the deep sleep at night, that's very healing and restorative. Well, some people don't get that deep sleep anymore, and that's part of the reason why we have so much disease and stress now. But Reiki is able to put people into that healing, restorative, like, sleep place for a whole hour or more. You know, Reiki will do that for you. It's like passive meditation, but you do get off the table feeling re-energized. And you're right. I mean, most people in today's society don't get that little blip of restorative sleep that our ancestors did. And Reiki really does kind of provide that for you. And it's a lifesaver for me. And I, you know, Colin, I would love for when you do go get a Reiki treatment that you let me know what you thought.
Oh yeah, you're going to be my sounding board.
Okay.
I've already decided that, because I don't know what I'm receiving. I mean, somebody could say, okay, you need to stand on one leg with your hand on your head for 10 minutes and you're going to feel wonderful. And, you know, I'm an Englishman. I'll do it. What do I know? You know, like
www.whiterosepath.com.
Fabulous. Eileen, you take care until we talk again.
Colin, take care. You too.
Ladies and gentlemen, Eileen Smith, Reiki Master, also a paranormal investigator with the South Jersey Ghost Research Group.
Welcome to the shadows of the night zone.
And on the 22nd of September, I had the pleasure of welcoming back my old friend David Baker. Now, David's a spiritual guide, angel therapy practitioner, psychic medium. And David's appearance always brings heavy call volumes from people needing psychic advice or just wanting to test in to see if it's legitimate. David Baker. Yes. And we're here tonight with David Baker, psychic medium. And last week, we chatted with Eileen Smith, actually 2 weeks ago, David, from the Path of the White Rose Center and 12angel.com, and she's also a graduate of Dr. Virtue. Both of you seem to have a very strong sense of purpose. Is that a natural gift, or is that gained from teachings?
That's a very good question. I think there's a lot of commonalities there that bring people together that are drawn to certain groups, like Buddhist groups, healing groups, angel groups, and so forth and so on. And I believe a lot of us have different aspects of the spiritual realm imbued in us when we come here, and so we're naturally drawn to different things. So Eileen and myself, drawn to Dr. Dorian Virtue for some reason, and it proved out to be one of the things that help us in our lives so we may help others. And I believe that's what it is. Like, for example, Nita Hickok, for example, she had her training. She did what she had to do, went her direction, and I mine. But when we all come together, we come together for a common spiritual goal. But yes, there are some people that specialize in angels. A lot of people got the angel training, and some people went on to specialize in that. I didn't. I have a whole cacophony of things that I work with, but still, I keep it within certain boundaries. I don't go past those boundaries. But yes, there's a commonality between us that attracts us to angels. A knowing that if it's a male or female first, because of their energy is different, male and female alike. Additionally, I'll get, at the same time, a vision, it may be clear, it may not be totally clear, that the person's a male or female, what they look like. I might see some colors and how they're dressed. That's why I was able to tell one was a female and the other one was a male, an American Indian. It feels different as well. Some people like the mysterious, or maybe they're drawn to, you know, battle or investigate those types.
Right.
I'm not. I prefer to go to the higher realms to keep myself surrounded with white light and good intentions and only make connections with those from the light.
Spirit that we talked about on the last show that was around me had a very deep impact on not only myself but friends who knew the individual, and that fascinates me.
That is amazing. And I just want to throw this out because I didn't have a chance to say everything, but in the beginning when I was communicating, they threw out a C name. I forget what the name was, but I wrote down the C. I don't know if that means anything to you, but I just thought I'd throw that out there to you.
Different levels of senses when communicating, you know, the clairvoyant, the cognizant, and all that other stuff. But can you visualize the spirit as if it was in solid form?
Most definitely. It's just like I'm looking at a photograph, or even better yet, like I'm looking at somebody in person.
And does it take any particular preparation on your part? Do you have to meditate, or do you use Reiki, or any of those mind-clearing methods?
Well, most definitely you have to get the energy going. And what I do is I protect myself with white light, and I ground myself, because when I do this, my spirit comes out of my body, and I don't want to be all, you know, floating around and whatever out of my mind. So I ground myself, my spirit comes out to make the connection. You know, I'm stabilized, and I don't come to my body too fast when I'm done. Additionally, I open up my chakras, and I do a certain Tibetan method of tapping, which helps to open up my meridians.
Mm-hmm.
And I clear my chakras, and I visualize, I check them and make sure they're all open and doing good.
Right.
And then I do a little meditation and prayers, of course, of protection. Ask my spirit and angel team to help me out. Welcome in spirit, and I send love from my heart chakra to all those that I'll be working with. And then I'm starting to open.
Right.
Open
now,
up, that's how I open up. This is unusual. I could be sitting in a restaurant and talk to somebody and tell them there's a spirit around and just give them a reading. I've done it before. But my preference is to go through these preparations here, especially if I'm going to do in-depth readings or a lot. To do this, it really helps make me a much clearer channel.
I have with me tonight, of course, our old friend David Baker. David, when you tune in to the frequency of a person and a spirit, or as we used to say in the 60s, when you feel the vibe, is it an immediate connection, or is there a protocol to go through before a full connection can be made?
I don't even have to be with the person. They could be on the moon. It doesn't matter, because the energy I use is like a matrix. It's universal, it's infinite, and its speed is, you can't even calculate, it's so fast, it's faster than the speed of light, it's instantaneous. As soon as my mind and the other person's intentions, person wants me to read them or whatever, and I look at them, and already I'm starting to see something. And I've raised my vibration, like it's like a radio dial. You're trying to tune it to the right frequency. Only I really don't need that dial on me because I'm so used to doing it. And I believe I have, perhaps in past lives, being a medium, so I'm really, really have that energy around me. And I have the, what I believe was I was born with the extra software to do it. So for me, it's instantaneous. I'm able to just make that connection and start seeing and sometimes hearing things.
Right.
And my energy goes to that person's energy. We make a connection with the energy, of course, yes.
Right. So do do you sometimes come across spirits, I guess the best way to explain them is criminal intent spirits or tricksters or angry spirits? Do those ever happen while you are trying to tune into whatever it is that you're listening for?
That, I would say, no. Everything's been clean, very clean, very beautiful experiences during my readings. The only thing I've got that felt a little funny, and it wasn't bad, were people that were suicides who seemed to come from a different area. When I see them, they come from lower left and come up and are in front of the group of people from the light that I'm seeing. But as far as negative entities or anything like that, when I'm not doing the reading, when I'm not open up, because I got powerful protection around me. But just when I'm walking around somewhere, then I will get those types of spirits, because I might be walking around somewhere where there's negative energy, or like Nita Hickok says, there's some areas that just have negative ley lines that have spiritual vortexes that open up to where negative spirits can come through, or lower astral spirits. But I do encounter them by going places, but not in my readings for sure.
In the virtual studio, so how do you deal with those disbelievers, or those that build that wall around them of non-belief of the energy? How do you get them to believe or understand the energies that they have? I'm sure you must come across people that, even though they allow you to do a reading, they blatantly will not accept the information.
I've been done a group reading with another person who did something else. One of the people that came there, I gave them a pretty good reading, as I did everybody in the audience, a really great reading. I had no problems. The only deal is the person after the event told the other person that I was conducting the event with that they didn't believe in what we did, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, even though we proven it out to them. And I'm totally fine with that. And I'm also fine with skeptics. And I really don't get bothered by those type of people. I don't get challenged. And I'm not here to battle those type of people. But there are some people, a skeptic, I will tell them, let me give you a reading, you know, if you come to me for it and see how you feel about it. Additionally, I'll say if you want to know more about this, open up your mind. Because most of the time I ask skeptics that don't believe this stuff, it's because the way they were raised in their belief system, and they had not had a reading before, they had not done research, they know nothing about, so they have right to be skeptical about it, but they have no right to judge until they do research. Now, there's a difference between those, and I believe that it is healthy to challenge the unknown until you can get confirmations in the information. But a non-believer is different. You can't talk to a non-believer because their ghost of their grandmother can appear for them, talk to them, give them a cup of coffee, smack them in the head, whatever, right in front of them and disappear, and this non-believer still won't believe it. They'll think they're delusional or something.
And David's accuracy is absolutely outstanding. His access to the spirit world is truly amazing. And David Baker, spiritual medium, check him out. Well, David, we have a 252 caller on the line. 252, I'm going to open up your microphone. Please, your first name and your geographical location.
Hi, my name is Kima, and I'm from North Carolina.
Do you have a question for David?
Yeah, do you see me getting a job really soon?
Hi, Kima. Thank you for calling. And you just continue pursuing what you're doing. I don't see anything fairly soon right now. Sometime this coming year, I see possibly something, but again, wish I could give you better news that, yes, you will be getting something, but not what you're looking for until sometime this coming year, probably around May or something like that. However, between now and December, I see a possibility of some part-time work that you may have to sell for right now to help that additional income to come back to you. But what you're really looking for that brings more stability into your life, I'm afraid, dear, that at least in my opinion from what I'm seeing, won't be coming until perhaps around this coming May, somewhere around there. But the key is not to give up.
Okay. I was planning a major move, and I was needing that job to make this major move. Do you still see me moving to this area based on what you're telling me?
I believe that not only will you do it, but I believe that that would be necessary, and perhaps that would help a great deal toward manifesting this a little bit sooner, perhaps. See, you see, everything I see of different possible futures, we all have it, just like the Earth has it too, is the most likely path that you're going right now. And if you go on that particular path, perhaps you may manifest something a little bit sooner.
Okay, so just keep on thinking, keep on working towards my goal of moving, and maybe something will come up. That's what you're saying, that will help me along.
Not maybe something, some money.
Some extra money.
Something will come up, not a maybe, something will come up, and never stop. Because when you stop thinking about it and working toward it, that stops the wheels of progress and puts a damper on everything that you've worked and hoped for. So keep on going, and yes, you will find something. You have a very healthy attitude and the willingness to get something, and it will come to you.
All right. Okay.
There you go, Kim. Did
thank
that
you.
Answer your questions?
Yes, it did. Thank you
well,
so much
thanks.
For your reading.
No problem.
Thank
you. You stay with us there and join us in the virtual studio if you would like. So, David, there's a lot of heartache and a lot of pain out there in this financial world of lately. Does it cloud readings? Is it like a technical fog for you, or does it not do anything as far as reading a person?
Doesn't affect me at all. I go right through to what I see, no matter what is going on. And I really trust my gift because I feel it's fairly sharp, and I trust it. And I feel that the minute I start having doubts about it and want to try to tell somebody something that they hear, that it turns out to be not really, terrible.
Right.
So I don't go there. I just go right into what I see with their energy in the future instantaneously, and I just keep talking right away. That
mm-hmm.
way I know that I'm seeing what I'm seeing.
So you keep the good energy and expel the negative, let it bounce off you, so to speak.
That is correct. And I'm a human being, and I may not be 100% perfect. I don't claim to be. To different degrees, I'll get a lot of hits that will resonate with somebody, and sometimes there's some information in there that may not be the best, but I can only give what I can see, and I know I can see pretty well. But as far as this, the way the world is right now, it's a tough time for me to be in this position, I suppose, because I get so many people asking a lot about relationships, but mostly about work these days and money and everything. And I have to tell them the truth, and I have to tell them what I see. And I wish I can give them better news at times, and sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. But I just have to be true to my gift and to the person I'm giving the reading to, no matter what comes through. Earlier on the show, when I mentioned some things to you in the reading, I mentioned mother or mom, and I'll mention it again because I took notes. I see that it's not your imagination. They do what they need to do. When your thought opens up to them, it's like they're not reading your mind all the time and around you all the time. They're doing their things. But when your mind starts thinking about them, it's like you're saying, hey, mom, but it's mental telepathy. You're thinking about your mom. She gets the message, and it's like inviting her to think about what you're thinking about, and she hears that, and she might come, stroke you on the hair. You might feel a cool breeze, warms a tingling or something, or maybe even see something or feel something. But it's not your imagination. That's definitely the way it works. And it's happened in my home and to many other people that I know.
And David Baker, absolutely fabulous. His readings are just spot on, especially this next one. You got to hear this one. In for a penny, in for a pound. 111, your geographical location and first name, please.
Sarah, California.
And do you have a question for David Baker tonight?
Yes, I was wondering if you see anyone around me trying to give me a message.
You have an older male and a younger male, or a male that died younger, and there's also an older female around you too. The older female feels like a grandmother or an aunt, perhaps. Male feels like somebody close to you, and so does the younger male. Does that make any sense so far?
Yes. Is the younger male a relative or a friend?
I think this person may be a friend of yours.
And
they just want to let you know that they're still connected with you on the spiritual side. That there's a reason why you've noticed this, and perhaps you've heard them trying to telepathically or some other particular ways know that even though they are there, they're still close to you.
That's good to hear. Because my daughter's best friend's little brother passed away a year ago, and the anniversary was just 2 weekends ago on a Saturday. And I never forget about him. I think about him all the time, and hoping that he's passed on to a good place.
Did you get the signs, like anything that reminded you that you thought would be a coincidence? Because that's their way of letting you know that they're still around, like a dream, a music, or a picture, or something, feathers, a bird, anything. But they're telling me that they try to give you a sign. So if you haven't noticed anything, or maybe you forgot, pay attention, and you'll get something as a confirmation now that you have confirmed that they are there. Still
okay.
Connected to you.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you, caller?
Yes, it does.
Good. Well, thank you for calling. We appreciate your time. So, David, how do you do it? I mean, seriously, you say you tune into a frequency, but how do you hit these bingo calls each time? Now, I've been watching the numbers, David, because you know me, Mr. Skeptic, trying to find out, well, is this kind of, you know, on the level? And this is absolutely on the level. The numbers that are coming in are absolutely random numbers from around the country. And how do you do it, sir?
Once she started talking, or I knew who it was, the energy made an instantaneous connection, and I can see who is connected with her in spirit right away. Above her, I saw a noted male energy, which is also a guide for her. And to the left of him, as I'm looking at him, was the grandmother. To the right, and a little bit over to the right, which is not like direct family. It could be a different relative or somebody that's a friend of family. To the right, younger male in spirit. Instantaneously, I saw these people. So as I'm wondering what she wants from who, that's why I had to ask her. And then she said, could this be a friend or family? So I asked the spirit, and I got instantaneously, telepathically, that this was a friend. The spirit is already saying thank you, because the spirit is honored that the situation has been pushed to the past, it's understood, and that there's a willingness to move on. And yes, there's love and happiness there, and a feeling of releasement.
David, once again, sir, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and we hope you will come back with us in a month or so, and we will talk again. Now, your website is davidbakerspiritmedium.com. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Wow, I got it right first shot. I must get golden points for that one. David, it's been a pleasure. My regards to you, you and Cheryl. Blessings upon your household, sir.
Thank you, and likewise, and to everybody that listened to the show today. Thank you so much. God bless you all.
And ladies and gentlemen, David Baker, great spirit medium, brings a great deal of information to our show every time that he is on. And he does bring a great deal of information. What a fabulous person. And just a genuinely nice guy.
You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com.
Finishing off September was my old friend from CNN, Marshall Masters. Marshall is the master of the Planet X forecast, and we kind of stepped back about 2 years in interviews and had Marshall go over exactly what is Planet X. What's it all about, Alfie? And Marshall, in his own special way, definitely told me.
But one that you know is there because of the way it interacts with known bodies that you can observe. Now, this is also a name for an object that people have heard it as Nibiru, with the work by Zachariah Sitchin and his book on the 12th planet and the whole series. And also, it was very extensively documented by the ancients. They called it many different names, the destroyer, the frightener, the doom shape. So there's quite a bit of record of it, and in fact, it was called the Destroyer in the Holy Bible as well. And so it is, this is a captive object. It passes through the system. And what we can tell you is that we do not know exactly what kind of object it is. Is it hard and rocky like an asteroid? Is it like a comet such as Hale-Bopp? Or is it a mini constellation where you have a large central body with several moons, planetoids? So that exact nature of what exactly Planet X is uncertain right now because it has yet to be officially observed. However, at some time that there will be that. But what we do know about it is that it is big and it is entering into the southern skies of our solar system. Yeah, principally right now, it's because of the way it is interacting with the sun. For us, a real acid test was actually NASA's Ulysses probe. It did with ESA. Now, that probe, unlike most solar probes, or excuse me, probes that they put up in space, which go along the ecliptic. Let me, I'm going to be using this term ecliptic quite often tonight. So let's define that, and let's imagine a point in the center of the sun, and then we draw a line out in every direction, you know, a large plane, if you will, that cuts through the all of the known planets in our solar system, which are going to be on it or just above or below it, and all the way out into the 12 signs of the zodiac. And that's the ecliptic. It is the plane of the solar system. And, you know, the southern skies are going to be what's beneath the ecliptic. Northern skies are going to be above. But then when we think in the terms of east and west, like legends on a map, what we really need to think of is towards the center of our solar system or towards the edge of the solar system. Now, the object is traveling. It's inclined to the orbit. It's inclined to the ecliptic, which means unlike the planets, which are going around and around. You might say it's going from in a path that takes it bottom to top and back around again. And something that's in a comet-like orbit tends to be unpredictable. You know, planets, we could sit there and set a calendar on it. I mean, they're so reliable that astrologers make a nice living.
Right.
But comet-like objects, no, that's a different thing. They can be, you know, generally they can be fairly predictable, but they can be highly unpredictable when they're inclined to the ecliptic like this. A good case in point was Hale-Bopp, and that was, remember that cult that all committed suicide to ride the back of the comet's tail? Well, you know, this was... That comet had had a substantial reduction, as I recall, somewhere between 30-40% of its orbital duration as it was passing near to Jupiter. And when I'm saying passing near to Jupiter, it was just a little bit less than the distance between the planet Venus and the Sun.
Okay.
And it came close enough to Jupiter to alter its orbit significantly. So that's what happens with comet-like orbits. They're unstable, unpredictable. If we had all of the computers in the world hooked together, there would be no way for us to actually say with certainty where this object is going to be at any one time. You know, when folks ask us what's the most likely worst-case scenario, all I can really say right now is that there is no most likely worst-case scenario because this thing is so unpredictable. We have a video we put up on our site at yowza.com. It's a February 2009 report. We give 8 different fly-by scenarios, all the way from a best case to a worst case. But, you know, the only thing we can really talk about with any kind of certainty right now is that you have to plan for the worst, hope for the best, which is, you know, good advice for most things in life. If you want to have an event that you would keep in mind, something that you could say, all right, if I'm going to visualize a worst-case event that I need to deal with, what would that look like? Well, that I would say, go watch this new movie by Sony 2012 when it comes out in November. What they're showing, what we can see from the trailers, and we've been following all the trailers since they started bringing them out, is an Edgar Casey pole shift scenario. Now, how it comes about, I don't know. They don't show what triggers it. But what they are showing is certainly an Edgar Casey pole shift, because you're having tsunamis, super volcanoes, and so forth. And that would attend that kind of an event.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, it's for your listeners out there. Yeah, I mean, it's a natural tendency, Colin, to want to say, all right, I'm going to get a handle on this so that I know, well, you know, when do I have to take it seriously?
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's be frank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it comes to Planet X, people read the information like they read their credit card statements.
Right.
Now, most people, when they look at their credit card statements, gloss through them for something that would leap out at their eyes. They basically ignore most of those insane, you know, fees that we get assessed.
Right. Just hit the bottom line, right?
That's minimum monthly payment. Write the check, mail it in, and we'll deal with it next month.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really not the case here, because for folks, if they're not prepared for it, what happens when all of a sudden we're all standing out in our yards, pointing up at the sky, going, oh, nuts,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, at that point, everyone's going to make a run on, you know, Army surplus stores, Kmart, what have you, stock up on provisions. The only thing is that there's going to be shortages, and if you do find something, you're going to pay 3, 4, 5, 10 times more than you would pay for it today. So the advantage of looking at the information today is that it puts you in a position to prepare you and your loved ones. I chuckle when I see folks say, oh, well, let's buy gold, let's buy gold, let's buy gold.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was in St. Petersburg, Russia, and I met this woman. And a lot of folks don't know that the city of Leningrad, now St. Petersburg again, sustained the single greatest loss of life. There was a 900-day siege by the Nazis, and 1 million people were starved to death. A very brutal way to die. And in the city, this woman's job was, she was in a bakery, and she sliced bread. That's all she did. And people would give her gold Rolexes encrusted with diamonds for an extra quarter-inch slice.
Wow.
All right. Now, think about it. Right now, you can go out to Costco and buy a 50-pound sack of flour for peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put it away, and it'll last 10 years if you keep it dry.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it make sense to just go take a few dollars out of your pocket, buy some beans, buy some flour, buy these basic staples that are all of a sudden going to dry up and disappear in a disaster? And know that you've got that, as opposed to auctioning off all your family heirlooms for a quarter-inch slice of sawdust bread.
Right, right.
So.
And Marshall, you know, he brings it home. He tells it just the way it is.
We're coming upon a situation, and I think it was really, really well said in the Colburn Bible, which we published. Now, this is an ancient secular wisdom text. It was written about the same time as the Old and New Testament by the Egyptians and then by the Celts. Both of them talk extensively about this object. The Celts called it the mm-hmm. Frightener, which I like that term the best. I like the way the Celts called it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Celts predict that it would be in this time, and so do the ancient Egyptians. And they wrote their part of it just after the years after Exodus. And they tell us that the 10 plagues of Exodus were the result of Planet X, but so was Noah's flood and the sinking of Atlantis. and the harbinger signs that they've given us for this are coming to pass. But there's one thing that the ancient Egyptians state, and it has always been something that I hang my hat on, so to speak. And what they say is, the stout-hearted will not go down to destruction. Now stop and think about that. That's a really simple statement. The stout-hearted will not go down to destruction. If you're some kind of Machiavellian, perverted, gang-banging jerk, you are not stout-hearted.
Right.
And all of these people who express their lives through these, you know, through fear, control, exploitation, domination, what's going to happen is they're going to wind up feeding upon themselves. Because, you know, earlier you had this caller and he said, hey, you know, when it comes to it, I'm bugging out. I'm going to go to my big, you know, chunk of land out here in Texas and to heck with y'all. And that's really smart. And the point here is that people like him, like you, who would get together with like-minded people in your town and find a way to get away, is that you're going to understand that there's nothing to be gained in confrontation with these dark-minded people. Right, they're dead-enders. And so what you do is you just get away from them, because you understand confronting them is, first off, in a cataclysmic situation, you know, there's not going to be a lot of folks running around with emergency rooms and antibiotics and painkillers. So, you know, good Lord, I mean, you could just get a simple cut and die from that in those kind of circumstances. So you don't want to get into anything where you're going to be injured. There's even a small injury can result in death. So what do? You pick up and you walk the earth. You get away from the idiots.
Yeah.
And what they will do is they will just, without anyone decent to feed on and steal from and demoralize and exploit, they will just turn on themselves.
Mm-hmm. Almost like Sodom and Gomorrah.
In a manner of speaking, yes. I mean, they'll realize their own outcome. And then, you know, what you're really doing is you're going out and you're finding places that are going to be peaceful and quiet, and you avoid it. You know, remember that movie Dances with Wolves?
Yeah.
That last scene where, you know, after Dunbar says goodbye, and then, you know, and then sure enough, here comes the cavalry, and you think they're going to go down there and completely decimate this village.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens? They get down there, and they just find they're gone.
Yeah.
They're just not there. So that is the way you deal with it. You avoid the confrontation, because you know that the dark-minded people are just going to exhaust themselves. They're going to eat themselves.
And that's Marshall Masters from the Planet X Forecast. If you get the chance, go check out his website, Marshall Masters. Just type him in Google. He's all over the place. Yowza.com is his main site, but you can go through Planet X Forecast, and that'll take you over to Yowza. And in the virtual studio, we have a gentleman that's been with us for quite some time and has always been there during our shows, StrangeVisitors.net, Mr. E. The Stranger. He also has a Blog Talk radio show, and if you get the chance, he's on at 9 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Mountain time, so that'll be 11 p.m. Eastern time. If you get the chance, come to the blogtalkradio.com network and check it out, because he's definitely worth a listen. A little bit more risque than the Night Zone, but I have to tell you, he's funnier than heck. And his reviews are some of the best in town. So that's Strange Visitors, strangevisitors.net. Go check out his site and jump through to the Blog Talker radio show and listen to what Mr. E. The Stranger has to say.
Into the shadows of the Night Zone.
And about 2 minutes away from the end of the night. And that concludes our September guest list. And next month, we've got some great guests coming up. Next, we have Scott Mandelka. Scott was with us about 6 months ago. And a great show. I know you're going to enjoy it. It's going to be an absolute blast. But we have to get out of here. Take care now.
Hey guys, got a minute? You know, I'm sure we all have friends that are having tough times, either financially or in their marriage or in their general relationships in life. But for the grace of God go I. Well, I have friends like that. As they look to me for advice, I look to the heavens for some form of divine inspiration so I can please the masses, I guess. It doesn't always happen. So what I would like to say to you tonight is, if you have friends, embrace them. If you have loved ones, cherish them. If you have acquaintances, respect them. And if you have love, show them.
Blessings upon your households. Good night.